The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And so they want to deny that it's a coup. And so the way they're saying this is that that Mugabe is still commander-in-chief, but they're acting to protect him against malign influences around him. And one of the things they've done is they've arrested a number of cabinet ministers who had been affiliated with the First Lady. And so they're saying that they're doing this in support of the revolution and in fact to protect the president. But if in fact this was done to protect the president, then it would have been the president who'd gone up on TV, and it wouldn't have been the middle of the night, and he would have told the nation himself. The fact that it's a guy in a uniform means his actions are undercutting his words, and very deliberately so. But this leaves us in an interesting position because they want Robert Mugabe's blessing for the transition. They want him to say that he's going to step down voluntarily and that he's approving a transition to a new government of some sort. And he seems to be resisting this.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 18th, 2017. The tanks were in the streets in Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe was being overthrown in a military coup, and I knew exactly who to pick up the phone and call. Nani Hall Singh is a professor at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He's also an old friend, and he's the author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups. He's the guy who knows more about more different coups than anybody else you could possibly imagine. He also knows a lot about African politics, and I thought it would be fun to have him sit down and chat about what's going on in Zimbabwe and how it maps on to his larger work on coups in general. It's a wide-ranging conversation about coups over the decades and about politics right now in the Southern African country. And yes, there's even a Woody Allen reference. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 262, Zimbabwe and the Strategic Logic of Military Coups. Nani Hall, I feel a little bit like Woody Allen in Annie Hall, where he pulls Marshall McLuhan out from behind a signpost and says, well, I happen to have Marshall McLuhan right here, because I happen to have a coup expert right here. So the question is, do you feel at all like Marshall McLuhan?
Suppose in Annie Hall, he's one of the better characters to be, although my favorite in there is Howard Cosell.
although that's in a different movie, but yeah, I agree with that.
It's in Bananas. No, because the whole reason why I'm interested in coups is not because I have some sort of authority, but just because I've been fascinated by them for so long. So for me, it's unlike the Marshall McLuhan character, it's a lot of fun to be able to engage with public discussion when things like this happen.
Okay, so you are the author of a book called Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups. How many other books that are not by you are there on the subject of military coups as a phenomenon in politics?
There are a good number of them. One of them, the most famous, is a book that long preceded me by Edward Luttwak called Coup d'État, A Practical Handbook. But what I did, which other people weren't able to do, was I was able to talk to a large number of people who'd participated in coups and get their perspective. These were people who had mounted coups, people who'd opposed coups, people who were in the middle trying to figure out what they wanted to do when the coup went down and whose actions were very consequential. The other thing that the book has is it has a statistical analysis based on a data set of over 500 coup d'etats. Attempted coups. As part of writing the book, it meant that I had to compile and review over 500 different case histories of coup attempts. And so that means that when I see something like Zimbabwe, I'm thinking about it in the context of a large number of other previous coup attempts which have occurred in different places at different times.
So before we get to Zimbabwe, just give us a working definition of a coup, because it's not the same thing as a revolution. It's not the same thing as a bloodless coup, right? Well, like, slice the onion for us. What does the data set consist of?
Sure. So a coup attempt is when some faction that has to involve military and security personnel attempts to take over control over the government. So it can't be a revolution, which is people in the streets. It can't be an invasion. It has to be a collective action, so it can't be one person trying to assassinate a president. And the intention has to be some form of executive replacement. It doesn't mean they have to take over power themselves. There are a number of coup attempts which have been intended to put someone else into power or to create space for a democratic election. But the key part here is that there has to be an attempt at executive replacement. And for me, a coup succeeds when they are able to displace the previous ruler for at least a week.
For at least a week?
Yeah, that's an arbitrary thing. It has to do with trying to figure out when is it enough. And there's some governments that haven't stayed in power for all that long. There were a number of cases I had to decide where a government stayed in power 7 or 8 days, and how did I want to code them? Any definition is arbitrary. But in general, once they were in power a week, they were in power a month or a year, there seemed to be a fall off. That generally speaking, it was pretty clear who was in power quickly, and things were consolidated within a week. Most of these, it's consolidated within a day.
Okay, so when you saw or read or heard the news about Zimbabwe, I assume your reaction to it was a little different from everybody else's, because everybody else says, wow, a coup is going on in Zimbabwe. And your reaction must have been something like, wow, another coup, right?
That's right. Once you've seen a lot of them, you you notice when there's one more. When they grabbed the radio station, it was very clearly a coup. But even before that, when they were moving tanks down the street, there was a good likelihood that we were going to see a coup attempt. It's possible we would have seen some sort of show of force to be followed by a negotiation. You see that occasionally when you've got disputes over pay. Sometimes when you've got disputes over policy matters. For example, in Argentina, once democracy was restored, there were attempts to try to prosecute people who had been part of the military for human rights violations. And then there was a series of uprisings called the Carapinta Uprisings, the Painted Face Uprisings, which were designed to try to make sure that there were no human rights prosecutions. And they actually were able to get amnesty for everybody who had been convicted along the way. But by and large, once you're out there and you've threatened the president, and you've shown you have both the ability and the willingness to do so, you don't back down. Because at that point, if you go back to the barracks, you're vulnerable to reprisal. You've lost the advantage of surprise. So usually what happens at that point is they take over. In this case, in Zimbabwe, what's fascinating is that they've taken over while denying that they're taking over. And so they've said, this is not a military takeover of government. There was a great tweet by the party youth wing where they said, contrary to international reports, the gallant Zimbabwe army has not staged a coup. There is no coup in Zimbabwe. Neither is there a crisis. The army is simply affecting a national democratic project, and it's doing so with peaceful aplomb. A peaceful aplomb is a really great euphemism for a coup.
Yeah, it sounds like a good name for a band, actually.
Peaceful aplomb is my stripper name.
All right, so let's back up and talk about what's happened in Zimbabwe. And Mugabe has been in power for a very long time. He's quite old. He's run the country into the ground.
And he's been able to retain military loyalty throughout this period, which is one of the interesting things. So the electoral process lost legitimacy.
So what are the background conditions against which this peaceful aplomb took place?
What seems to have triggered it is the impending succession crisis. Mugabe's 93, he's getting frail. His wife, Grace Mugabe, is angling to become his successor. And recently what happened was that he removed his vice president, a longtime compatriot of his named Emmerson Mnangagwa. And the reason why this is significant is that the removal of this faction would then open up more space for Grace Mugabe to be the designated successor. But this was a problem. Grace Mugabe is not very popular. She's known as Gucci Grace by her detractors for her extravagant shopping. Their kids are known as sort of profligate spendthrifts. There's an Instagram picture, I think, some form of social media, where the son is pouring champagne on an expensive watch, and there's some sort of caption about when your daddy runs the country, you can wear watches this expensive. And so there's, she is not necessarily highly popular. There's also generational tension. There are the people who came in, the revolutionary generation, the ones who came in with Mugabe, many of whom have been successively purged from government. And there's the newer generation who are associated with Grace Mugabe. And so there's a dispute between these two factions. And by pushing out the vice president, the succession crisis, which would have happened at some point in the future, got pulled up to the present. People didn't want to lose the high ground now, because if they did, it would have made life very difficult in the future. And in this case, the vice president had long been associated with security affairs. He was very close to the head of the army. And so it's sort of our rough understanding is that there's a faction that represents the head of the army, the vice president, perhaps others, and they're the ones who mounted the coup.
So a few years ago, Zimbabwe was very much in the news because Mugabe had this election in which he got himself elected to another term. There was a lot of violence. There was a hyperinflation. And, you know, then, of course, as these things tend to, it settled into a kind of longer term disappearance from the public eye. What are the background conditions in Zimbabwe these days like? Is it, you know, how repressive is it? How bad is the economic environment? Does this coup take place in the context of a succession crisis alone, or is it also a succession crisis in the context of a near-failed state?
So the Zimbabwe economy, which had hit massive hyperinflation, and then at one point, and then that was tamed because they largely gave up on the Zimbabwe dollar. At one point, there were trillion Zimbabwe dollar notes. They moved to the U.S. dollar. But even that hasn't been enough. And so at the current time, there is, according to the unions, 90% unemployment. The economy is not doing very well. It's propped up by China, that China had been one of the sponsors of ZANU during the independence period. And China is one of the major investors in Zimbabwe at present.
For listeners who don't know, what is ZANU?
Once upon a time, Zimbabwe was known as Rhodesia. It was a state which had an apartheid-like system, much like South Africa's. It was a white dominant system. And there were a number of different independence factions. And the one associated with Robert Mugabe was ZANU, which then at a later point, after another party merger, becomes the ruling party that's known as ZANU-PF. So the point here is that China had been a backer of Robert Mugabe since before he was prime minister and then later president. They were involved in the anti-colonial struggle that Mugabe spearheaded. And they are now, at this point, one of the key investors in Zimbabwe. I heard that they're currently constructing a big resort near Victoria Falls. And this is important because Zimbabwe doesn't have a lot. They're an agricultural country. They export tobacco. They have some minerals and they have some tourism. But ever since they became an international pariah, and also ever since the event that brought them in the news was that there were land seizures from white farmers, but the people who took control over the farms were largely politically connected, and they didn't know, they weren't good farmers. Zimbabwe has had agricultural problems too. So at the current time, the Zimbabwean economy has been struggling a good deal. They're propped up by China, but they're not in good shape. The unions claim that there's 90% unemployment. And so all of this is a condition of state weakness, one way or the other. He's been able to retain the loyalty of the military throughout this, despite these problems, because he's continued to pay them. During the war with the Democratic Republic of Congo, they were up there protecting certain mines and they were paid in diamonds. Once they came back, they probably are receiving Chinese money, and they also are ideologically committed to the protection of the revolution. In 2008, when it looked like the opposition might have won, they made it very clear that they were not willing to support any government that did not have proper revolutionary credentials. And so he's been able to weather a number of different storms, bad economic performance, and also loss, increasing loss of legitimacy over time. However, what seems to have done him in was this move to remove the vice president and for Grace Mugabe to be to move into position to be the likely successor. She also had publicly insulted the vice president in some remarks that she'd made. And so things were reaching ahead in advance of Mugabe's passing away. That sort of the event horizon got moved up.
Okay, so you said before that it's unclear, that it's pretty clear to you that there was a coup, but that the leaders of the coup deny that there's a coup. And so walk us through what happened here and how the party that acted wants us to understand it and how you think the right way to understand it is.
So they followed the standard coup playbook. They put tanks on the street. They took over the television station. A general in uniform made a broadcast in the middle of the night to let us know this was not a coup and the president was safe. The streets have armored personnel carriers on them. The president and his wife are under some form of house arrest. So it's very clear that the army has taken control. And I want to be specific here because it's the army and the head of the army in particular, as much as they'd like to claim support of the entire military, the head of the army recently appeared at a press conference with 90 other high-ranking military officers, but missing from this was the head of the police and the head of the Air Force. And so anytime there's a coup, people want to claim the military as a whole acts, but it's always precisely a military faction. Now, why is it that they might want to pretend it's not a coup? What's going on here? And there are two factors. One of them is that a coup is a bad word now. You can get kicked out of the African Union if it's a coup. It is rumored that before the coup took place, that Chiwenga, who is the head of the army, went to South Africa and he was told, look, you can do this, but it has to look constitutional. It can't appear to be a coup. And so they want to deny that it's a coup. And so the way they're saying this is that that Mugabe is still commander-in-chief, but they're acting to protect him against malign influences around him. And one of the things they've done is they've arrested a number of cabinet ministers who had been affiliated with the First Lady. And so they're saying that they're doing this in support of the revolution and, in fact, to protect the president. But if, in fact, this was done to protect the president, then it would have been the president who'd gotten up on TV, and it wouldn't have been the middle of the night, and he would have told the nation himself. The fact that it's a guy in a uniform means his actions are undercutting his words, and very deliberately so. But this leaves us in an interesting position because they want Robert Mugabe's blessing for the transition. They want him to say that he's going to step down voluntarily and that he's approving a transition to a new government of some sort. And he seems to be resisting this. Today he went out and he handed out university diplomas, or actually I don't know if that's literally true. He gave a commencement speech at a graduation. And so they're giving him some freedom and they're engaging in public negotiations with him. His photo and the general's photo is on the front page of a newspaper. And he seems to be resisting giving his permission. He wants to wait until, I believe, the next party Congress. And they want him to approve a transition that's occurring a lot sooner. There are some antecedents to this. When there was the coup in the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev was on vacation, and the junta reached out to him, and they wanted him to approve of the coup, because they were doing it to preserve the Soviet Union from dissolution, and he refused to follow through. Another interesting and perhaps more ominous antecedent here has to do with the end of the imperial rule in Ethiopia. Here the similarity here, you have two figures who have a good deal of respect. And so Emperor Selassie is removed at the beginning of the summer. He loses de facto control, but he isn't de jure removed until almost September. And there's this period of awkward public compromise, which ends finally with the military junta getting impatient and pushing him out. And this ends later on with the death of Emperor Selassie. And so there's always the possibility that they might get impatient and say, you know what, we're going to move President Mugabe into some honorary status. We're going to make him the honorary figurehead, but we're going to remove any practical power from him, and we're going to peacefully put him out to pasture. That still leaves open the question of what happens to Grace Mugabe. I think they would like her to go into exile, but she seems to be resisting that as well. And so Mugabe's using this leverage where he's refusing to approve of what's happened, and he seems to be engaging in some negotiations. What the content of those negotiations is, we don't know. There's a lot here which is still uncertain, not only to us, but to Zimbabweans as well.
So we are now coming up on a week. And is it clear in your mind yet whether this is a coup attempt or a successful coup?
It's very clearly a coup attempt. We're a half a week right now, but I think it would be very unlikely for this to unravel. I think at this point, the army has clearly taken control, that they don't have any problems with control. There is precedent for it unraveling. The Soviet junta had been in full control over the country, and then they believed they'd lost control over the military, and so they abandoned power. But that's a very rare thing. It seems unlikely that this is going to unravel at this point, although I could spin out some scenarios on the less likely end of things. What I think we might see is an awkward period of a month to 2 months where Mugabe is still around and they're trying to get his stamp of approval, but they're also threatening to move on without it.
So, Nani Hall, if I were organizing a coup, I would not leave the person I was removing both alive and in country and free, in any sense free. The person I was displacing wouldn't be giving commencement addresses or handing out diplomas and wouldn't be around for a kind of public kabuki negotiation dance. They'd either be on a plane to some other country, or they'd be in a prison cell, or they would be dead. And the question is, why are coup leaders not a little bit more Jacobin about removing, you know, about handling people who are potentially a really serious threat to their to the success of their endeavors?
Because of the symbolic importance of Robert Mugabe as the founder of the nation, and because they see themselves as engaged in more or less the same enterprise. In some ways, there's similarities to the Soviet coup. They see this as a preservation of the revolution rather than an undoing of it. And so if they were to throw Mugabe into jail or, God forbid, execute him, they would be very clearly marking a break with that previous period. And by doing so, they would lose a good deal of international legitimacy. And what's more, they would make governing more difficult for themselves. I think what they're trying to do is to inherit as much as possible of the governing structure as they can, and do so by trying to get to maintain as much continuity as possible. Now, we may still see what you're describing. I mean, if you consider this, the Jacobin period isn't the way that the French Revolution starts. It's what the revolution merges into. If you look at what follows the Ethiopian coup, the big purges come later on. And so it's not unheard of that things might change later. But I think at this point, there are good reasons for trying to do this as softly and gently as possible, particularly when you're dealing with a 93-year-old. So there are two things which are important here. One of them is the immense symbolic importance of Robert Mugabe, and this is something that people in the West tend to overlook. Mugabe is a George Washington kind of figure. He is a Nelson Mandela kind of figure. He's an independence leader, and he still has a good deal of symbolic legitimacy, even if he has not been governing effectively. What people say is, oh, that's not Mugabe's fault. It's the fault of the people around him. And so as much as possible, they want to act delicately. They don't want to go head to head against Mugabe. particularly because the vice president has been so strongly associated with Mugabe, and it's very hard for them to disclaim Mugabe without damaging his legitimacy as well, and damaging the legitimacy of the army chief, who had also been very close to him, and who'd also been involved in many of the actions that they might criticize Mugabe for example, the human rights abuses in Matabeleland in the 1980s. So any criticism against Mugabe has a risk of boomeranging back. The other bit here is the international climate. They have the support of China, it seems. There was a rumor that they sought the support of China ahead of time. When the vice president was removed, the general happened to be, the head of the army, happened to be in China. And so he would have had the opportunity to have discussions with them. And it looks like the Chinese are not trying to throw up any obstacles. But the rest of the Southern African region and the rest of Africa would be very unhappy if there's a coup. And so they want to avoid the appearance of a coup. They want to make it look like a house cleaning of bad actors within the government, but still a symbolic reaffirming of both the president and the government and the symbolic legitimacy of the revolution.
I'm interested in your sense of the coup batting average in general. You distinguish between attempted coups and successful coups, and you define a successful coup as one that the staying power of the replacement government is at least a week. So when you see an attempted coup underway, what expectation should a news consumer have that a given coup is going to succeed by your definition? Or does the average coup kind of fall apart? I mean, once there are tanks in the street, are we looking at a coup that's likely to succeed, or are we looking at something that's likely to be a flash in the pan?
So when I looked at 500 odd coups over 60 years, it was fascinating because the odds were 50-50 at that point. Since then, there's been a decrease in the number of coup attempts, but an increase in their success rate. So we're now above 50-50. That said, what matters is who is engaging in the coup. The least likely to succeed coups are coups from the bottom, are mutinies, basically, coups by low-ranking officers or by enlisted men. And those tend to be almost like revolutions. They're big, they're spontaneous, they're unruly, and they really depend on the mutiny catching fire throughout the military. And the problem is that by their action, they are threatening not only the government, but higher-ranking officers as well. And so they've got a built-in opposition. High-ranking officers will often act to try to put down the mutiny and restore order.
But there are some really famous examples of that, right? Like Nasser's coup in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the Soviet Revolution is in fact a mutiny as well. It starts with Russian naval officers. The flip side of this is coups from the top, coups that involve generals. These are the ones which are the most successful, not for the reason that you'd think. So the question becomes, why is it the coups fail? And the reason why coups fail has not got to do with popular opposition. It has to do with opposition within the military. And it turns out that the way in which you make a coup succeed is that you make it seem as if its success is a fait accompli. Here's the risk with a coup. Anytime you divide the military, there's a risk of fratricidal conflict, which can slide into civil war. This is how the Spanish Civil War took place. There was a coup, and they couldn't resolve it, and you ended up in a very bloody civil war. So the minute things start up, people are standing there going, I might approve of one side or the other, but what I want to do is support the side that is going to win, because support the side which everyone else is going to support, because then we can bring this to a resolution without a lot of bloodshed. And also, by the way, I don't want to be on the losing side because there might be some penalties for that. And so you see people crossing over. People who had supported one faction may back people who had previously been loyalists may back a coup if they believe everyone else is going to do so. The interesting thing is this process of creating self-fulfilling expectations, which is critical to a coup, is most easily done by high-ranking officers. And so coups which are done by generals are the most likely to succeed. And so, in fact, when we saw this coup attempt, the fact that it was done by the head of the army was a very good sign that it was going to succeed one way or the other.
So, Nani Hall, one last question. Your book is entitled The Strategic Logic of Coups. Briefly, what is the strategic logic of coups?
So the strategic logic of coups has to do with what happens during a coup that leads it to either succeed or fail. And in particular, it has to do with the way in which the coup makers succeed by creating self-fulfilling expectations. They have to grab control over the mass media. They have to use the mass media to convince the rest of the military that their success is a fait accompli. Once they do that, people will start backing the military because they believe it's going to succeed, and these beliefs will become self-fulfilling. In that way, it's very much like a currency crisis or a revolution.
In other words, coup as confidence
absolutely.
Pyramid.
Absolutely. If you consider things that we think of as hard, like the economy or power, it's amazing the extent to which there's social underpinnings here. A dollar only has meaning because we expect that everyone else is going to respect the value of it. The minute people lose faith in the value of a dollar or in a value of a bank, the value of it goes away, it can evaporate. Same thing with a revolution. A ruler might have a large army, but if everyone in the army believes that the ruler has been toppled, as we saw in East Germany, people in the military and security forces will put down their weapons and walk away. The Stasi walked away from the East German regime. And so your ability to stay in power has less to do with the number of guns and bullets and more to do with your ability to convince everybody that everyone else is going to support the coup, and that if you step out of line, that everyone else is going to support the government. And if you step out of line, you're the only one who's doing so, and you're going to get arrested easily. Conversely, when you mount a coup, you have to convince everyone that everyone is going to support the coup and that any opposition is going to be swept up quickly. And so this is the strategic logic. It is, in fact, very much a confidence game, like you said.
Nani Hall Singh is a professor at the Naval War College. He is the author of The Strategic Logic of Coups. Nani Hall, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Nani Hall for getting on the phone on short notice to talk about Zimbabwe. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan. If you haven't already left the Lawfare Podcast a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever social media service you use, get on it, people. I'm tired of having to do this. If you haven't already shared the Lawfare Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media, get on it, people. And of course, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com